And now he's on tenure track at Virginia Tech, and he's going to tell us what he's been thinking about.
Right, and it really is what I've been thinking about. It's by no means a finished product. So what I'm hoping to do today, and I'd like to thank the absent Owen for inviting me over, first of all, and inviting me to give a talk at the last minute. So that as of 5 minutes ago, I was still scrambling to get everything in order. But what I want to talk about today is demons, 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 information theoretics, statistical mechanics, and the second law. And this the work is effectively an extension of, or partly an extension of what I did in my dissertation that's been moving forward, because I explicitly wanted to avoid talking about Maxwell's demon in my dissertation, and that was, I think it was relegated to a footnote at some point, the whole thing. Because I had a certain problem with a lot of the discussion of information theoretic approaches to statistical mechanics as one finds it in the literature, in that it's almost entirely entirely comprised of theories, entirely comprises discussions of Maxwell's demon and discussions about Landauer's principle versus Sillard's principle or Verdun's principle or whoever, however you want to characterize the principle that measurement is associated with this guy. Entropy dissipation, entropy dissipation. And what struck me is that this isn't in itself anything that's comparable as an interpretation, as a bona fide interpretation of statistical mechanics, as compared to your standard Boltzmann interpretations or Gibbs interpretations and the variants that go along with those, insofar as we should be able to say something positive on a whole range of foundational issues in statistical mechanics from an information theoretic perspective, and limiting ourselves to Maxwell's demon doesn't seem to be a way to accomplish that. So more recently, I've been turning my attention back to Maxwell's demon, and I've been trying to approach it from the perspective of information theoretic approaches, but trying to do so in a way that leaves aside at least the question of Landauer's principle. And I want to, and at least today what I want to do is I want to give you a sense of why that is and what my motivations for doing so are. So as a basic outline of the talk, what I want to do is I want to repose the question of what's the challenge of Maxwell's demon for statistical mechanics? And this turns out to be a question, I think, that relies on the answers to a bundle of questions. And part of that involves an understanding of the way an understanding of classical thermodynamics, the relation between statistical mechanics and thermodynamics. So I'm going to try to draw that out in a number of different ways, partly on the basis of Ehrman and Norton's dilemma that they pose for information theoretic exorcisms of Maxwell's demon. They call the sound of the sound horn. And then furthermore, on the basis of an example drawn, a simplified example drawn in the Sillard engine, and how particularly David Albert and a more recent paper by Meyer Kemo and Orly Schenker suggest that a demon is in fact possible. And they take this from explicitly a Boltzmannian perspective. And the question I want to pose is, how should we I want to take this at least as a model for, if not a correct interpretation or answer to Maxwell's demon, at least a model for what I think would be a clear answer to Maxwell's demon. And then what I want to do is, at the end of the talk, go through a considerably more promissory try to answer the question, or at least pose the question, what is meant by an information theoretic second law, and then give two proposals, and surprisingly, perhaps, the literature on Maxwell's demon, or the literature on that I found on information theoretic approaches to statistical mechanics, doesn't do a terribly good job of answering the question, so I wanted to make a quick motion to two suggestions that are made by Janes in different papers of his. Okay. So generally starting off, as I've already said, the motivation behind Maxwell's demon is a challenge to ask whether or not the second law of thermodynamics is in fact viable, given the fact that thermodynamics we don't expect to hold absolutely, but when we recognize that it is only true of a statistical nature, that is, we expect fluctuations, and Maxwell, of course, asks whether or not we can exploit those fluctuations in such a way that we can violate the tenets of thermodynamics. And as I pointed out, most presentations of the exorcism of Maxwell's demon adopt what they call an information theoretic approach to statistical mechanics, coupled with Landauer's principle to show that such a demon is impossible. But just saying that, I think I have a clear understanding of what Landauer's principle says, or what it claims, but at the same time, I don't have a clear understanding of what's meant by the second law of thermodynamics from an information theoretic perspective. And so what I wanted to do is to, at first, at least, try to spell out why I think that's an important question to answer, or why I think that's not in any way obvious. So firstly, what the second law permits or excludes is clearly a matter, in some sense, of interpretation. So how we understand the question posed by a Maxwellian daemon, as far as I can see, depends on three factors. The first being, more broadly, how we understand thermodynamics, classical thermodynamics, and more specifically the second law, since we're looking at Maxwell's daemon. Secondly, how we interpret the formalism, or what formalism we even use in the case of statistical mechanics. And thirdly, how we interpret the reducing relations that exist between the two theories. So posing one and posing the other won't necessarily give us the answer, because generally, we often expect our understanding of the reduced our reduced theory to be somehow altered in the course of the reduction. So in the case of statistical mechanics, we might want to revise our notion of entropy in some sense. So for instance, in standard in entropy, at least in classical statistical mechanics, is understood to be a state function of a thermodynamic system, whereas perhaps, say, on a standard Gibbsian formalism for statistical mechanics, the entropy is a function of the probability distribution that isn't necessarily going to depend solely on the thermodynamic parameters, in at least in some cases. Okay. So what I wanted to sort of draw out of this early juncture is that recognizing the statistical nature of thermodynamic phenomena forces us to revise our understanding of what the second law does or does not forbid. And Maxwell's daemon is a challenge to providing such an understanding, that is to further inquire as to what kinds of violations are possible and which kinds are not. And how that understanding will be effective is going to depend on how one understands both statistical mechanics and its connection to the terms that appear in thermodynamics, such as those of entropy and temperature. So given the preponderance of information theoretic exorcisms, the questions we should be asking is, or among the questions we should be asking is, how are we forced to reconceive of the content, or the empirical content of thermodynamics, in the light of an information theoretic interpretation? And more specifically, as I pointed out before, the question I'll be trying to raise, and by no means come close to answering, is how one ought to state a second law in information theoretic terms. That is, given an interpretation, an information theoretic interpretation of statistical mechanics, how is one going to properly state the second law? And to sort of motivate, or to sort of draw out some of the issues that arise here, and to expand upon them, I want to talk a little bit about Ehrman and Norton's dilemma that they pose for information theoretic exorcisms of Maxwell's daemon, and they divide such approaches into the sound and profound horns, where the sound horn presumes that Maxwell's daemon is itself a canonical thermodynamic system, and thus itself subject to the laws of thermodynamics. Contrasted with that is the profound horn, where they claim that Maxwell's daemon is not itself a canonical thermal system, but the possibility of violating the laws of thermodynamics is somehow blocked by adding to the description of such of the daemon some information theoretic principles such as Landauer's, which makes the connection between this, logically irreversible operations and thermodynamically irreversible operations. I think this is, in some sense, a false dilemma. Yeah.
What was meant by calling Maxwell's daemon a thermal system? I mean, do you just mean a physical system?
No. Well, there could be physical systems that are not themselves thermal systems, but we're presuming that Maxwell's daemon is some kind, is not a supernatural being. But the idea is that somehow Maxwell's daemon is itself described in the life of the laws of thermodynamics.
Thermodynamics,
that's
the underlying mechanical laws.
Well, that's what I'm about to say a little bit more about right here. This is why I think this is a false dilemma, at least on one interpretation. Right? It's a false dilemma simply because, as I point out here, no system in nature is actually a classical thermodynamic system. So is that... and of course, the whole point of investigating the possibility of such a daemon is to determine whether it's possible to violate a statistical version of the second law. So, in effect, we're refusing to answer if we choose the sound horn, at least in the way that Ehrman and Norton initially suggest or pose the horn, then we're effectively not answering Maxwell's question at all, because it's just not we're asking a different question, one that's easily answerable. We assume that both Maxwell's demon and the system that the demon is operating upon are both canonical thermal systems that are, strictly speaking, systems that obey the classical laws of thermodynamics. There's no question as to whether or not they can violate the laws of thermodynamics. So, right. So, Right. So, a few points on that I can say. Firstly, it's not the case that they introduced this dilemma after they've analyzed all the different supposed exorcisms. They introduced it before, and then they try to show that any proposed exorcism either does one or does the other, is either on the sound horn or on the profound horn. And they suggest that this is a massive confusion in the literature because it's not always clear or obvious which one is being taken, which horn is being embraced. So in the case of Charlie Bennett, he explicitly in a later paper comes out and says that he endorses the sound horn. And so what's the purpose of the sound horn? Well, he says that there's no way in which we can violate the second law. That's a presumption or a constraint upon any system. So in a sense, we're not in effect answering, or we're presuming the answer to Maxwell's demon is no, and then for Bennett, as I think he says something like, but it's of a pedagogical use to answer why. So what Landauer's principle allows us to do, or the analysis permits us to do, is to identify at what stage in the operation of any proposed demon, the violation of the second law is forbidden. Right, so he calls this some pedagogical use or something like that. I mean, and by contrast, you see people that embrace the profound horn in some of their in some of the examples they consider, but also you see someone like Oliver Penrose in Foundations of Statistical Mechanics seems to embrace something like the profound horn, even in von Neumann's Mathematical Foundations of Quantum Mechanics, he seems to embrace something that sounds like the profound horn. But I mean, this is nice in terms of a framework. But I think there's more to be said about the sound horn once one moves away from talking about it as being a classical thermodynamic system and talks about it as being a statistical mechanical system, or what one means by a statistical mechanical system. So that's what I wanted to go on to say here, is that if we're going to try to have this dilemma retain its bite as being, and leaving the question of Maxwell's demon as an open one, as opposed to adopting the sound horn and closing the question immediately, we have to choose the sound horn or understand the sound horn to reflect choosing the demon to be a statistical mechanical system. And that is, we have to have some antecedent understanding of what it means for a system to be a canonical statistical mechanical system. Okay. And Norton and Ehrman in their papers present a set of criteria for what they mean, but I take those criteria to be overly restrictive. So they demand that the system obey Hamiltonian equations of motion and that they possess suitable properties such as ergodicity and mixing, which strike me as being overly strong requirements. And in fact, I think they probably preclude a liberal version of an information theoretic approach right off by fiat if you require that the system be mixing. And Norton sort of spells this out in terms of sojourn times and establishing probability distributions that cover the phase space and infinite time. So he spells out what he means by a canonical thermal system, at least as a sort of first pass example, by appealing to properties such as ergodicity and mixing that probably aren't true of real systems in any case, and certainly aren't part of every interpretational system of statistical mechanics.
If you just compare these two, let's say thermodynamics, second law, and then information theory, can you tell us what is the basis of each and where the potential contradiction comes in? If we could just drop the demon and then the sun, the horn, and all that for now.
where the potential contradiction comes in.
Well, okay, here is the information theory, right? And there is thermodynamics. And apparently, these horns, different horns, sounds, you refer to what they refer to, refers to some demon. Let's drop the demon for now.
Right, okay.
Can we just go back to the basics? And are you trying to point out some fundamental contradiction? The way I understood Landau's principle, the causes in inequality and all that, is well within the body. And as you pointed out, Bennett basically just offering the assumption that second law should not be violated, or at least there's no such thing there. So could you just drop all that of those other things and just get down to these two basic theses?
I'm not really sure I understand the question, but what I'm motioning towards is that we should be able, if we're going to offer an information theoretic approach to statistical mechanics, whatever that may mean, whatever that is, should be something that allows us to conceive of a system characterized by an information theoretic approach as being a canonical statistical mechanical system and should proceed from there. Right. So in the case, I'm putting aside Bennett's proposal because, like I said, I think he's not really telling us anything about what one means by an information theoretic approach to mechanics. Rather, he's adopting a constraint on any approach to system mechanics, and then he's deriving Landauer's principle from it. What we prefer generally is a constructive story, right? So what we want, adopting the sound horn, changing the sound horn from being this claim that we assume it's a classical thermodynamic system to being a canonical statistical mechanical system, is that this should allow us to give a constructive story as to what the second law actually states on it. So let me see if I can rephrase this. So if we have a high-level theory such as thermodynamics, and we have a lower-level theory such as statistical mechanics, and we think that we should be able to explain the behavior of thermodynamic systems by appealing to the fundamental, to a more fundamental description at the statistical mechanical level, the answer should proceed from the bottom up, not from the top down.
I think we agree on your last sentence. But where does the information theory come in, and what is the question? What is the issue? What is
it seems to me you should develop the talk, and in the process of the whole talk, you'll...
Right. Well, I probably won't answer the question itself.
I think that's the subject of the talk.
Yeah. I'm begging for here at this point is simply that we need to have a proper understanding of what it would mean to have an information theoretic approach to statistical mechanics before we proceed to answer the question of Maxwell's demon. And I'm going to use the literature of Maxwell's demon as sort of an example to draw some of the issues that I think arise. Okay. So as I said just a moment ago, I think that Erwin and Norton, just as a note, I think Erwin and Norton are overly restrictive in what they take to be necessary conditions on any interpretation. But I want to turn now to just one of the first questions I raised, which is that there's some ambiguity with regard to how we understand the second law of thermodynamics. And as Jost has put forward in a very long paper a few years ago in Bluff Your Way at the Second Law of Thermodynamics, there's considerable ambiguities in just what one means by the second law of thermodynamics. And so I've just sort of picked out three sort of well-known examples of statements of the second law, and I want to point to a certain way in which these can be understood as being different claims or non-equivalent, depending on how you understand the terms that appear in these claims in these statements. So the first one is simply the claim that you can't have a perpetual motion machine of the second kind, where you continuously extract heat from the environment and turn it into work. The second claim is the familiar Kelvin statement of the second law, where it's impossible to perform a cyclic process with no other results than heat is absorbed from a reservoir and work is performed. And finally, we have the sort of entropy principle that claims that in a cyclic system, there's this inequality that holds only in the case where, and the equality holds only in the case of a forceful transformation.
Is the difference between the first and the second only that in the second case you demand a cyclic process, and in the first you allow an arbitrary process?
Well, what I'm going to point to is that it depends on how you understand the term cyclic. So, So to point out that the key term that appears in the latter two formulations is how one understands the word cycle. And I want to distinguish between, I guess, two senses of the word cycle. The first sense is that the system must return to its exact initial state, ready to run anew, and that would be exactly what one would expect in the case of a perpetual motion machine that returns exactly to the same initial state at which it began, and then it can run it again, continually extracting heat from the environment and converting it into work. In a weaker sense, we can just say that the system must return to its initial thermodynamic state, or at least one with equal entropy, such that there's a reversible transformation that takes it from that state of equal entropy to its initial state, thermodynamic state, though complete recovery of the initial state isn't required. So for instance, in the example that I'll proceed in a moment, we might have the system be in a different, wind up at a different position than it initially began. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there seems to be just something a little bit, that bit in the brackets there, you kind of, that's not something that you normally I think that, I mean, what you said is that the reason why that with at least one with equal entropy is justified is because you're taking for granted that there is then a further reversible process that can transfer you from the equal entropy state to your initial thermodynamic state. And it's important to bear in mind that qualification because that's the only reason why you can just amount adding that bracket.
I don't think the brackets are as. I'm not sure that that's even necessary. I mean, one way to interpret the question posed by Maxwell's demon is, look, can we have a system such that the system returns to its initial entropic state, never mind its, returns to the exact same parameters, while extracting heat from the environment and converting it to work? That might be sufficient to generate Maxwell's demon, right? So on some interpretations of what would be required for Maxwell's demon, that would be sufficient in and of itself.
What I'm flagging up is that there's going to come points in the future when precisely that extra qualification is going to turn out to not be possible. So you're going to have things that are going to apparently be equal entropy, but that actual reversible path back to the initial thermodynamic state is not going to be available because of the nature of the way it's happening.
I believe that might be the case, that might happen, but I'm not sure that's important for my purposes. So I'm willing to concede the point, I suppose. Okay, so if we interpret the relevant notion of cycle to be that of a strong sense, then the Kelvin formulation becomes roughly equivalent to the claim that we can't construct a perpetual motion machine. Whereas, it implies the entropy principle, but it's not equivalent to it because the entropy principle is going to be understood as being somewhat weaker than that. Right? In the weak sense, the Kelvin principle is equivalent to the entropy principle in that it talks about cycles referring to the to the original entropic state, but it fails to show that a perpetual motion machine is impossible. And I wanted to give an example sort of based on this Sillard engine, sort of classic example from Maxwell's demon to sort of illustrate the point here. So we consider, my computer graphic skills are limited, so I just sort of set it here if I can draw something. We consider the standard setup of the Sillard engine where we have an engine, a one particle gas in a volume V at a temperature T, and we have a demon that has a memory cell, which is also modeled as one particle gas at a temperature T. And it's in some ready state, which is, say, arbitrarily chosen to be the left side of the box, and there's a one particle gas here, then a partition is dropped into the box, the engine, such trapping the particle on one side or the other, and let's just say for simplicity purposes of explication, it's the right side, and the demon performs a dissipationless measurement on the system and correlates its state to the state that to the side which in which the solar engine the particle in the Sillard engine is trapped. Then the partition is removed and a piston is isothermally expanded, extracting KT ln 2 units of work from the system. And then so at the end of this system we have the Sillard engine back in its original state. Right? It's just the very same state it began. And we have at this point Maxwell's demon sitting there with now its memory cell in a different state than it began. But this is exactly the same thermodynamic state as the initial state. Right? It's, in both cases, it's a thermodynamic system at temperature T with occupying a volume of V over 2. So in the weak sense of a cycle, it's complete because we've recovered the same thermodynamic state, although it's not the exact same state, the position of the state differs. So in one sense, on one understanding of what it means to be a cycle in this weak sense, because we've recovered the exact same thermodynamic state, it seems that we've effectively constructed a Maxwell's daemon. Okay, so this is what I just said here. Okay, so as I point out here, the Sillard engine is returned to its initial state, and the daemon's memory is in the exact same thermodynamic state at which it began. It's a one particle gas at a temperature T combined to a volume of V over 2. But we, of course, note that because when we drop the partition in here, the particle could have been on either side, and the daemon's memory gets correlated to whichever side it's on. We can't actually predict with any kind of certainty which side, what the daemon's final state is, but we do know with certainty that the daemon is in its initial thermodynamic state. Well, there's no perpetual motion here because presumably, unless you return the system back to its initial state, you can't do it over again. Right, so you need to recover the initial state in order to run the whole thing over again. But insofar as, but if you take the weak sense of a cycle where you just have to recover a state of equal entropy, and in this case it's also the same thermodynamic state, in that sense, on the weak sense of a cycle, you have constructed a Maxwell's daemon. If that's how you're construing a violation of the second law, this counts as a violation of the second law in the weak sense, though in the strong sense it wouldn't be sufficient to give you the power to use perpetual motion. Okay. And this is just what I say here, that in the weak sense you have the initial state recovered, but in the strong sense you can't use this to do perpetual motion. And Albert, in his book Time and Chance, this is sort of an adaptation of the kind of situation that he envisions, because he thinks that he adopts this view that one only requires the weak sense of a cycle, and he thinks that this is sufficient to demonstrate that Maxwell's daemon is in fact possible. And the way in which he arrives at this conclusion is based on his presumption that the Boltzmannian approach to statistical mechanics, or his version of the Boltzmannian approach, is correct. So he assumes that the entropy, or the thermodynamic entropy, is a state function of the thermodynamic constraints operating on the system. And he, and as well as Hemmo and Schenker, who have extended his work, couple that analysis of the Sillard engine to a Boltzmannian interpretation of statistical mechanics, where we understand the entropy to be a property of the individual thermodynamic systems, and we understand the statistical mechanical analog of the thermodynamic entropy to be the relational property between the microstate and the macrostate of the system, where the entropy is, in a familiar way, calculated by ascertaining the phase volume of the macrostate to which the microstate belongs, and that's independent of whether or not we know what the microstate actually is. So I think that, at least as an example, this approach serves as an unusually clear and straightforward response to Maxwell's daemon. It gives us a clear interpretation of what the second law is. It gives us a clear, at least as far as I've characterized it, and we'll go further, it gives us an unambiguous interpretation of how the statistical mechanical analogs of the entropy go, and it clearly asserts that a Maxwellian daemon is possible. So at least in this respect, I think this offers a really nice model for analyses of Maxwell's daemon. And that's not to say, as I note here, that that's a wholehearted endorsement of Boltzmann interpretation of statistical mechanics. There may be other reasons why one might find it unpalatable. There may be many such reasons. And among them it might be that you don't like their interpretation of the second law, but you might not like it for some other reasons, say its description of the non-equilibrium processes or something like that. Okay. So obviously there are other responses possible. One's not forced to take, for instance, an interpretation of the second law that refers only to the weak sense of the cycle. One might prefer a stronger sense, as I was talking to Owen, he wholeheartedly endorsed a much stronger sense as being the interesting question. But what the interesting question isn't necessarily the question you have to answer. So the most common response that one sees in the literature, at least in the information theoretic exorcisms, is that there's not been a cycle that's been completed even in the weak sense, right? Why? Well, because we don't know as described here, we have no way of predicting or knowing which side of the box the memory cell, the particle that represents the demon's memory, is actually in. The probability distribution describing the demon's final state is going to be distributed over both sides of the box, or the phase space corresponding to both sides of the box. So whereas initially the probability distribution only covered this area, and at the end, because it could have gone, when we dropped the partition in and correlated the demon's memory with the state of the Sillard engine, it could have been on either side of the box. The probability distribution roughly covers both sides. And if we think that that's the relevant sense of a cycle, or we think that what's needed to complete a cycle in the statistical mechanical case is that the probability distribution that it started off in has to be returned to its initial state, or one with equal phase, or one with equal measure, then even in the weak sense, it won't be the case that the cycle is complete. And furthermore, we can also deny the Boltzmannian interpretation of entropy. We can deny that the entropy is, or the appropriate statistical mechanical analog of entropy, is to be understood as a property of the microstate, or a relational property between the microstate and the macrostate to which it actually is in, but rather is a function of that very probability distribution. In that sense, we haven't returned the entropy to its original value. And I take it that that's sort of the common response that one sees in information theoretic approaches, because they'll say that in order to return to complete the cycle, we need something that will compress the phase volume, and that's effectively Landauer's principle, that it has to do so in a way that's independent of which side the memory cell is actually on, and that requires an irreversible procedure. Unfortunately, as I tried to point out a little earlier, this is as far as most proponents of information theoretical statistical mechanics go. But this alternative interpretation only suggests a formulation of an information theoretic second law, and I think it's one that one can show pretty obviously that's clearly false, and at this point I'm going to become more and more speculative as I go. So the elements of what one might call a standard information theoretic approach suggest that the probability distribution that we're employing here is to be understood epistemically. It describes one's knowledge of a system, not any physical property of the system itself. And secondly, that the relevant entropy that we should be considering is not the entropy that's a state function of the thermodynamic constraints that are involved, but it's a property of that very probability distribution.
On the one hand, say, such and such is clearly false, and then at the same time admit that at this point you're going to become more speculative.
Well, yeah, maybe. I have a counterexample. Right, I understand. I think that there's a sense in which if you try to just give such a bare bones characterization, I'm going to give a counterexample on the next slide that shows why I think this is obviously false, or why it needs to be refined considerably. And then I'm going to be speculating about different ways one might refine it, and not giving you a good answer in the anti-comments. And that's what makes it speculative, is that I don't know. So here just are two slides for the counterexample. So if we took the Kelvin reading of the second law, we said it's impossible to perform a cyclic process that has no other result than that heat is absorbed from the reservoir work is performed, where we understand the natural interpretation on such a view to be a cycle where the probability distribution returns to its initial state, or at least something of equal measure, then it's really easy to construct a counterexample to the second law. So here's my counterexample. Suppose I'm in possession of a black box. The box has an on-off switch and has a weight with a chain, or a light rope attached to it. And I flip the switch, the weight goes up, flip the switch back down to the off position. Turns out that some heat has been extracted from the environment, the weight has been lifted, but the system is exactly in the same state that it started in. Well, it's just there. So I'd be interested to see what people have to say about this. But you have a black box of which you know nothing of its contents. It has a switch and it has a light rope extending from it that it's attached to a weight. You flip the switch, the weight goes up, right? Some heat is extracted from the environment, and you flip the switch back down to its off position. As far as you're concerned, the box is just as it was. It's in the off position. Some heat has been extracted. Some work has been done. Is that a violation of the law? Second law. Is that slow enough? So, voila. So I think we need to do a little more work in terms of trying to give an answer to exactly how we can construct an information theoretic version of the second law. Why wouldn't that be possible? I mean, the two don't even have to be related to one another. All we just need is something that's going to take some heat up. I don't know anything about the internal workings of the box. And yeah, it might not even be a heat pump. It might just extract some heat from the environment, store it somewhere, and then might have some battery that lifts the weight, for all I know. The two don't even have to be related. Yeah. Right. Okay. Why would we require that? I mean, that seems to be much. Right, but on this view of what would constitute a violation of the second law in the weak sense, we don't require something as strong as a perpetual motion machine. You have two options. You can either adopt something that just says any case where you. Why is that a better result? No, but I mean, the whole point is that we treat it as an open question as to whether such a law is, there is such a law. And then depending on how you construe the law, you might get different answers to that question. And A gives you the answer that the law is true, and B gives you that the answer that the law is false. Why should, that's not in itself a reason to say that I like the one where the law comes out true. You don't learn something by learning something is false. Well, I mean, you can make stronger claims, like claims about the impossibility of perpetual motion that might come out true. But if that's not the question you're interested in answering, then it's not terribly interesting. It may be the question you're interested in answering, and then in which case that's. No, I personally don't care whether the second law is true or false. I do in practice, but for my purposes, I want to leave that as an open question. It's something that can only be answered once we have a clear understanding of what the second law says, first of all, and secondly, what the appropriate underpinnings for the physics that are supposedly undergird the second law.
When one goes to statistical mechanics, it seems that they're no longer quite so equivalent, so that there isn't a second law. There's a number of different possible formulations of the second law, and one can establish, one can actually ask which ones of these are true and not.
Right.
So what you're asking is sort of lower down on the hierarchy, and what you're suggesting is higher up on a hierarchy, there's stronger versions. But it's still interesting to investigate.
Right, so I mean, now someone like Albert will say, this counts as a genuine violation of the second law, as I construe the second law. Does that admit perpetual motion? No. Okay, so we've got two answers. We can't get perpetual motion, but we can have violations of the second law because violations of the second law just doesn't develop perpetual motion, at least on his understanding. And, you know, if you say, well, no, it is about perpetual motion, well, then, you know, you can argue about it at that level, but at least on his terms, the answer is going to be clear.
Yeah.
So what I've been baffled by is that I don't really see anything that approaches a clear statement of information theoretic approach in information theoretic papers, well, what the second law actually claims. And the person who I've seen come closest to doing such things is E.T. James, and I wanted to describe two different suggestions that he has for what it means by the second law and give a brief explication, though I can't pretend to fully understand them or how they actually give you a clear interpretation, but at least they're the closest things that I found in the literature. So the first one that he offers is from a 1992 paper on the Gibbs paradox, where he argues that what the second law means is that an entropy decrease cannot be achieved reproducibly by manipulating the macro variables that we've chosen to define our macro state. So the idea here is that once we've selected a particular partition of the macro of thermodynamic parameters that we can we want to manipulate, then on those terms we won't be able to violate the second law, though relative to a different partition, it may well be the case that it appears that we have an entropy decrease. And the sort of example he gives is as follows. And this is something that actually is, I guess, independently suggested by Hemmo and Schenker in their recent Maxwell's Demon paper. So we have Bob and Alice who are looking at the same system, and Bob, and we have distinguishable particles from Bob's perspective. So he has slightly more control than Alice does over his, or Alicia, I guess I've written here, does over the system. So initially we have a box that's separated by a partition, and from Bob's perspective, on one side of the box, there's particles of type A, and on the other side of the box, there's particles of type B, but Alicia doesn't recognize that there's a difference between the two of them, and so she just sees a bunch of particles. Now, the partition is replaced by two semi-permeable membranes, one which is permeable to gap-type particles of type A, and the other is permeable to particles of type B, and both those membranes are isothermally expanded so that they can perform work relative to whatever they're working against, whatever they're permeable to. So work is done, and the gas is mixed. From Alicia's perspective, because she doesn't recognize the difference between the two kinds of particles, it seems that nothing has actually happened except that work is done. And then you can just insert the partition over again, and although from Bob's perspective, we now have gases of type A and type B having been mixed, from Alicia's perspective, it's just the same situation that you had initially. But for her, you can use that work to do lift weights and so forth. So it would appear from Alicia's perspective, because she doesn't have full control of all the macro variables that Bob does, that the second law has been violated. The example. So the question I'm sort of concerned about here is, so the suggestion here is that we have some freedom in choosing how we partition our system into sets of macroscopic constraints, and the second law is really a claim about what's possible given that partition that we choose. And this is, as I pointed out, accords with Hemmo and Schenker's analysis. What I'm struggling a little more to figure out is what makes this characteristically information theoretic. So in one sense, it might be the case that you might say that the entropy is relativized to a mode of description of the system, and it's not an intrinsic feature of the system itself. So in principle, one might argue that at least without some stronger restrictions on the kinds of dynamics or the kinds of particles that exist in the world, anything that's less than the full microstate of the system might be amenable to apparent violation of the second law from a more fine-grained perspective. So in this sense, the notion that the second law is always relativized to a partition, that's always something of our choosing about what we can control and what we can't control, seems to put the emphasis on the value of the second law in our hands rather than in the hands of the world. How do you mean? Okay.
It would be more of this flavor that Bob, knowing more about this system, mm-hmm. would be able to extract work from it.
whereas Alicia, so Bob would be able to extract work for himself. Alicia, not having that privileged information, would not be able to extract work from. And your example didn't contradict that. What it said is, if Bob says, look, I'm extracting work, ha ha ha, Alicia, I'm extracting work, and you didn't think that
it was possible.
It was possible. He's, you know, there's no real contradiction in that, because he says, in the end, I knew more than you did.
Right.
But it might be the case, if I understood you were posing the question, somebody might, by miracle, might have given Alicia these two semi-permeable filters. I mean, she wouldn't have thought of constructing those, because she thought, oh, these particles are alive. But somebody might have handed her these two filters and said, look, here's a device by which you can extract with. So whether you are actually capable of extracting work doesn't depend on your knowledge.
It depends on
what devices you are.
It depends upon the engineer's knowledge when he built that device.
Yes, but that engineer might be somebody else, didn't it?
I think that they're probably more so in the example I've given, there's something mysterious going on from Alicia's perspective, right? Because she's got this initial state recovered, yet work has been done, and you can give an explanation as to why that's possible. You know, the explanation is exactly what you gave, lobbying something that Alicia.
But at this level, it's the same sort of thing that would go on in a gambling casino. You know, here are these big, beady guys watching the gamblers. Mm-hmm. And they notice that this one fellow is winning more than they expect him to win. So they shuffle him out. And it's not mysterious. They say, ah, that guy has more information than he should about this gambling. So it's not a mystery that needs to be contended with. It's just a recognition of the fact that when you have privileged information, you can extract more work, which ultimately is the issue of Maxwell Deemann.
Right. And so, I mean, so it's a question. So I take it the way that Maxwell Deemann's broached in that case is that it's relative by, that what you need to do in any case is relative by such a state of knowledge, that you can't actually, given your state of knowledge, you can't actually break Maxwell's Deemann, but there can be trickery, as James puts it, that you can. There can always be a more fine-grained perspective that will allow you to do so. So what you're effectively doing is you're relativizing the second law to those variables that you actually manipulate. To those constraints that you actually manipulate, and if someone's manipulating a different set of constraints, you can say, "Oh, well, that's a trick. You must know something that I don't." But that's not a violation of the second law, because from the perspective of the constraints that you're actually manipulating, that's not going to count as a violation. It might appear to be one from my perspective if I was less, because I'm a fool, I'm not going to just assume that you're magic. I'm going to assume that you know something that I don't, in the pain of the casino example. Right, and that's exactly, I guess, what's going on in the case. Here, in the Siller example, right, where we say, well, it's not just that we're manipulating the temperature and volume, but we're actually sensitive to the position of the particle. And so you know something that I don't, as Maxwell's Deemann, that you have the ability to correlate your state to the position of the Siller engine, to the state of the Siller engine. And that's something that, as a matter of practice, that I can't do, and that's what makes it apparent that I'm violating the second law of denial. That Maxwell Deemann is violating the second law, though on Maxwell's own, on Deemann's own terms, that's not the case. So I think that's okay as far as it goes, but I'm really not clear on how that connects to the statistical mechanical formalism that we sort of wanted as an underpinning for the second law. Okay, so I'm not going to be able to get through anything else that I wanted to say. But the other suggestion that I saw, and I'll say just a few words about this, I guess, is in 1963, I guess it's in the Gibbs versus Boltzmann entropies paper, James offers what he calls an almost unbelievably short proof of the second law, and Ehrman in a paper in the mid-80s or something said he agrees entirely as long as you remove the word almost. And here I'm not really interested so much in the details of the proof itself, but what it might be able to tell us on the information theoretic kind of the second law. And the version of the proof I'm going to present, because it was very short, incredibly short, in the original paper, but this comes from a review article of Lavis Milligan from about 85 or so, reviewing the collective papers of E.T. James, and he draws more details on this proof from some other papers from the 60s. So I'm not really going to have a lot of time to go through this.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm going to go a little bit more. So he considers a system that's undergoing an adiabatic expansion. And we choose some set of observables, so some partition, and we make some measurements at some initial time of the values of those observables. And on the basis of those values, we construct a density matrix operator in the way suggested by the maximum entropy formalism, where we take the values of those observables to be constraints on the system and subject to the further constraint that it maximizes the information theoretic entropy in the way described here. And then we take that to be equal to that information theoretic entropy to be equal to the thermodynamic entropy. If we allow the system to evolve adiabatically, at some later time t, we can predict the future values of those observables just by evolving the density matrix. And given the predicted values of those observables, we can then define a new density matrix that's constrained by those future predicted values of the observables, and also maximizing the entropy, okay, in the familiar way. And because the initial entropy is invariant under unitary evolution, and both density matrices, that which we constructed our initial ensemble and that for which we constructed our final ensemble based on the predicted values of the observables, are both satisfied by the constraints. And furthermore, we know that the later ensemble maximizes the information theoretic entropy relative to those later observables, but the initial ensemble that we chose doesn't necessarily do so. It follows that we have the inequality that the entropy at the earlier time is less than the entropy at the later time, which he takes to be an argument for the a statement of the second law. So this is a very short proof, and
experiments represent a considerable problem for this.
No.
I mean, you start off and you have this entropy increase, but then if you continue to follow the system, you then find it drops down again.
That's fine. There's nothing. Why is that a problem?
Because now if you take a T0 to be the intermediate time.
Oh, but you can't do that. That's part of it. Right, so what? Here are the standard worries that one finds about this, and if you want to talk about spin echo experiments, these aren't worries, but benefits of the proof. The first is that, we don't seem to be able to get any of the details that we might want from non-equilibrium processes. We don't get transport coefficients. We don't get any of the details of the evolution based on that proof. Secondly, and this is the point to which you were just making, is that the inequality only shows that the entropy at later times is greater than or equal to the initial entropy. It doesn't show that you get any kind of monotonic increase. So there's no proof that for some arbitrary time t, at some time t at j, same time t sub j, then at time tj sub 1, that you have an increase in entropy, and that's perfectly compatible with this echo experiments.
But that also holds for the Cauchy statement. Second.
I haven't talked about that.
Well, that only says that in an adiabatic process, mm-hmm. if the system is originally in an equilibrium state and it's finally in an equilibrium state, then the entropy of the final state will be larger than the initial state. That orthodox formulation of the second law of thermodynamics says nothing about
intermediate states, and furthermore, I mean, it's not obvious how to define entropy in non-equilibrium states anyway, so it's not even clear that's even something desirable. So, furthermore, the other thing to point out about this proof is that it presumes that the measurements that you take at T0 are privileged in the sense that that's the only point at which you're actually taking any information in about the system, the state of the system, and then anything else is just predicted values on the basis of some dynamics or another. So these are the standard words, and you see these repeated all over the place. These are initially, originally in the Lavis-Milligan paper. They're in that Ehrman paper, which is a PSA paper from the mid-80s. You see that in Sklar's 93 book, and also it's repeated again in Frigg's recent review of approaches, interpretations of statistical mechanics. And I think that, in by and large, these aren't criticisms, in good criticisms in a number of ways. And a couple of them are, well, you might point to things like Spinetto experiments and say, well, why do we want a monotonic or the Cauchy formulation, and suggest, why do we want a monotonic increase in the first place? We don't have a good non-equilibrium definition of entropy anyways. But the proof only requires that the density matrix evolves unitarily, but it's otherwise silent about the kinds of dynamics by which the system evolves. So if we wanted to strengthen descriptions so that we actually had the actual Hamiltonian or something, presumably we could get a lot of those details. And secondly, the predicted entropy at the later times is assumed to be the thermodynamic entropy. So the idea was that if we're assuming that the new density operator actually gives us the thermodynamic entropy, then if we relax the assumption that we're actually predicting the thermodynamic entropy, but some other function, like our predicted knowledge of the system, not the predicted values of the thermodynamic entropy, then those sorts of worries seem moot. And all this is pointing to is going the other way. Yeah. Well, you're not making any measurements. No one's telling you. I mean, the presumption is that you're not making any further measurements. If you're making further measurements, then okay. What's the we're helping ourselves to an intermediate measurement. I'm not sure what you mean there. So we allow the system to evolve. Sure. There's just one time of measurement. Yeah. Right. Well, I think that that's sort of spoken to at this point, because we're making prediction. All we're doing is we're predicting values for the entropy. We're not actually making any measurements of them. And it's a further question if we want the predicted values to actually accord with the values that we might actually measure. Right. Exactly. Right. Right. Yeah. No, I think Owen gets, and I mean, it's. it's just that there's just the one measurement, right? You just have those initial values. That's all the information you're given, and then if you're given some late information at some later time, right? He has a formalism that he develops in later papers that deals with that sort of thing. You have the constraints that appear at time. He allows temporal and spatial variation in the values of the observables, and then you just use those all as constraints, and you run the same sort of MEP method by maximizing the information theoretic entropy relative to those constraints for all those times based on the evolution. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
like the landau damping really is not or dissipation in the streets from a chemical sense. So what's going on?
What's going on is this. Right, so what we're doing, going back to the original proof, is that we initially construct, we get an entropy value based on the values of the observables initially, right? That's the top equation there, right? So we just define the entropy in the usual way. And that entropy won't change, right? So that's stated right there. The initial entropy is invariant of your unitary evolution, right? But the second entropy that we're considering here, the entropy at some time t, right, what that entropy is defined relative to is the predicted values of the observables at some later time, and then we maximize that. So, so it's effectively a kind of coarse graining procedure that we developed.
Right, that's what I'm trying to get to. There must be some coarse graining. And could you make that a little bit more explicit? That is, when they start the measurement, like Chris said, this is it, this is a lifetime thing. What kind of coarse graining is being
The coarse graining is imaginary, in some sense. So what we're doing is we say that...
unless you are considering a different system, no longer closed system.
No, it's going to be closed.
I think the coarse grading is the fact that you're using just a finite number, restricted number of observers. I mean, if you...
No, it's doing the coarse grading is that what you do is you evolve the system, right? So you're using two different density matrices, right? So you take the initial density matrix and you evolve it to some time t. All right, that's going to be, that the entropy of that density matrix is going to be constant.
Is it under the same Hamiltonian?
Pardon?
No.
Yeah.
Is it under the same Hamiltonian?
At all?
But the predicted values of the observables, right, will give rise to a different density matrix of difference. So this is missing the knot there. So we can redefine a new density matrix that maximizes the information theoretic entropy relative to those values of the observables. So we're talking about two different density matrices.
Yes, the sort of coarse grading that's going on is that the presumption is that there are so few observables that are constrained, that whose expectation values are used as constraints, that there is going to be a class of density matrices that satisfy those constraints. There will be more than one of them. And that means that the maximization.
Or if there's only going to be one that maximizes,
yeah.
What's being appealed to in the proof is that we have unitary evolution that keeps the initial entropy constant. We know that both of these density matrices satisfy the constraints that are supplied by the observables, purely just the observables at that later time. But we know that only the new density matrix will actually maximize the information theoretic entropy, whereas the old one that we were using doesn't necessarily do so, and that's what gives us the problem.
So the discrepancy here, or the difference between the two, right, is that the second one, the rho t, right, that gives you the bigger entropy, is not following any Hamiltonian related.
No, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's just defined relative to the instantaneous observables that are.
So then let's examine what really, what are the conditions that you can come in and say, I'm going to do this. With no due regard as to what has happened to the original system following the Hamiltonian evolution, which we know is unitary, and there's no issue.
Well, there's not even a presumption that the evolution is Hamiltonian.
Right. So then it views upon whoever is coming up with this proof to state clearly the physical conditions which defines that particular measurement and the choice of this role. What is that?
There's no measurement.
There's no measurement and there's no physics involved. There's
right.
A topological principle that if all you know are these particular constraints, you should always choose the density matrix that maximizes the phenomenon entropy.
The phenomenon entropy at that time, right?
There's supposed to be a number of expectation values for a given time. There's a whole class of density matrices that will satisfy those constraints.
Uh-huh.
Each of those density matrices has particular phenomenon entropy.
Pick the one that has
the epistemic precision is your state of knowledge is best represented by that density matrix that allows you
the maximizes the maximizes entropy.
But it's not a question of some
that's just the prescription.
that's or being physical evolution through. That transforms.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah. Right, so this is, you know, and this is sort of what's being picked up on these worries, that we just don't have any dynamics here. And I think those are bad worries, because as Chris was saying, that's not what the proof is attempting to show.
It's
information theory. We're trying to ignore the dynamics. That's what James says, and I think so. What I want to say is going the other way. This is a particularly apt given what we've just been discussing. Is that if we think about the density matrix as characterizing our knowledge, why would we even require that the matrix evolves unitarily, that the dynamics is unitary? I think that unless we're some sort of Laplacian demon that actually knows how to follow the dynamics of a system, it seems like it's a surely false assumption that, you know, that our knowledge at some later time will be such that the initial state will, or that they, that will have the conservation of the initial information theoretic entropy. So rather than talking explicitly about dynamics, I think what one is committed to, or at least intuitively committed to on an information theory view, is that what we're actually trying to follow is the evolution of our knowledge of the system, and that may or may not have anything to do with the evolution of the system itself, especially if we're not given any further contact, epistemic contact with the system after we've made those initial measurements.
What then, is there a system that we could go by along the information theory in order to make sense of this comparison? I mean, if you come up with a prescription just for that particular purpose, then it's not quite physics, right? Maybe it's not physics that's being discussed here.
Right. Yeah, I think that's ultimately the worry. This is sort of where I wanted to wind up. This is probably a good place to sort of just try to finish up. There's this worry that I think that what you're really interested in here, if you want to characterize somehow statistical mechanics as really being about our knowledge of systems and fundamentally what the statistical mechanical formalism describes as our knowledge, then I think that even talking about unitary evolutions is possibly too strong. And the flip side to that, right, is that, as you just pointed out, that seems to obviate any relation, or that seems to get rid of any relation to the actual physics of the situation. So it's going to be very difficult, in fact, to try to make any connection. So we can start talking about the information theoretic entropy, but if it doesn't have any connection to the dynamics, then what connection could it possibly have to the thermodynamic entropy of the system that we're actually interested in describing? And so that's more or less what I say right here. So what I wanted to do, I wanted to go through a different version of proof, a slightly varied version of the proof, but the idea is basically just that we lose any connection to often that, although we can still define the initial thermodynamic entropy and information theory entropy as being equal, at a later time we don't have any means to understand what we mean by thermodynamic entropy. And that's roughly what I say here. We can make predictions of what the information theoretic entropy would be based on whatever dynamics happens to describe our knowledge, but it doesn't seem that that might have any relation to the experimental entropy or the thermodynamic entropy. So we can still get an inequality that says something like on some weak assumptions that still says that our initial knowledge will be greater than our final knowledge because we lose something, we might forget, whatever, but that's not going to tell us anything about thermodynamics. And the last thing I really wanted to say before I'll start finishing up is, in that sense, the results I get, which I just sort of ran through, is pretty trivial because it just says that we don't magically acquire knowledge, but we sometimes forget or lose knowledge by some means or another, and although we might later remember something, so the entropy can go back down, right, so you don't get the monotonic increase. But I just want to point out one quotation that I think inspired me to undertake this work was also from, I think this wasn't the Gibbs versus Bolton, I think this is the Brandeis lecture, but where Jane says the following. He says, for some distributions and in some physical situations, this is actually just a fragment, I guess, but he's talking about the information theoretic entropy has sometimes been recognized as representing a thermodynamic entropy. However, we have to emphasize that the information theory entropy and the experimental thermodynamic entropy are entirely different concepts. Our job can't be to postulate any relation between them. It's rather to deduce whatever relations we can from known mathematical and physical facts. And so, at best, I think that's on a that's a promissory note, and it's only something that can only begin to be answered in sort of looking at these kinds of proofs and maybe something else. But my final sort of comment is that we only have motions towards what we might mean by an information theoretic version of the second law, and what its relation to thermodynamics might be. And what we need, in some ideal sense, is something that aspires for the clarity that's and that's offered by the sort of Boltzmannian approach. So. I think I'm just sort of, as I said, it was very speculative. I just want to pose a number of problems that I see for trying to formulate such an approach. But I think this is a project that's well worth endeavoring to pursue. And with that, I guess I'll thank you. If there's any questions left after. Yeah, Chris. The almost unbelievably short proof
right.
of the second law.
The almost unbelievably short proof of the second law was an almost unbelievably short piece of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
A 63 paper.
Right.
So the challenge is, what was the rest of the paper?
Is this a challenge to me? This is testing my knowledge of the literature, right. I mean, he discusses a number of things. Let's see. So this is the paper where he famously announces that entropy is an anthropomorphic concept, and this is Gibbs' first book. Yeah. And what was the rest of the paper? Well, he goes through a few things. Let's see. So, you know, on the one hand, he has some various criticisms of the Boltzmann entropy. He gets worried about whether the entropy is defined relative to the average or the expected or the actual distribution. So he has a number of different worries about that. Then his main concern, as you pointed out, is talking about whether or not that the second law is really a statement of what kind of work can be extracted from the environment. So he says the real something like. What is the quotation? I'm not going to get exactly right, but it says something like that we now see the real reason for the second law. It has something to do with the invariance of the phase volume, that it cannot be decreased, but it can only be expanded. So I'm not sure what you're searching for. You're just asking for what the rest of the paper says.
Oh, okay. So I'll stop being devious and tell you what I think the rest of the paper was about.
I just haven't read it in a while.
The rest of the paper was about. Taking what you in the last quote called the experimental thermodynamic entropy and showing that it matched. So here's an independent definition.
Mm-hmm.
Take that number which controls how much work we can extract from a system. Call that the entropy. And then much of the rest of the paper was devoted to showing that at least in two examples that the experimental thermodynamical entropy did indeed match the information theoretically defined entropy.
In certain cases.
So the weak point that you made, that there's no a priori connection between those, pretty bigger part of the paper was showing that there is a connection.
No, I take as he's saying that there, he says they're entirely different concept. This is a different paper, that was a different paper that I pulled back last
They're independent definitions, but the attempt is to show that they do indeed match.
They don't always match. They couldn't always match.
Right. That's what he was shooting for. So it is a promissory note, but you presented it somewhat weakly, I thought.
Maybe. I mean, so here's, he does actually, he will say things, he'll say things like, look, when you define the information theoretic entropy relative to the observables that are actually operative on the system, then they will match in the expected way. The question is when they come apart, how do you minimize it?
Then there was also the example where he looked at gases with long-range interactions, and he compared the Gibbs entropy and Boltzmann's entropy.
Yeah, he gets really worked up. Yeah,
he showed that there was a connection between one of those concepts and the amount of work that could be extracted from the system, and there wasn't such a connection with the other concepts.
Right.
You guess which matched. So It's a promissory note, but it's not a promissory note without a promise.
No, I don't. I didn't want to suggest that it wasn't. So I mean, I think there are going to be situations when they match, and part of the job is to identify which situations those are, and figure out why those situations match and not others. So one might even think in terms of land hours principle, right? Why, you know, so if we have a probability distribution that goes over both of them, but the particle is actually the box, one reason. Or one way you might think you can try to deduce Landauer's principle is there's a constraint on the matching between the information theoretic entropy and the experimental entropy. So it's not just saying when they match, but under what conditions they match, and how can that matching be recovered in various physical situations. But those are questions that one might raise for trying to link thermodynamic entropy with the information theoretic entropy. But these are going to be. I think that's sort of a very broad project that I want to look at in more detail, but it is, like you said, a promise, and I think it is a promissory note. And James did do a fair bit of work towards making that move. And what I guess
he did about 30 more years.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Right, but I mean, part of my complaint, in some sense, about the information theoretic approaches to system mechanics is they sort of just sit on Landauer's principle and don't talk about all this stuff. And that's exactly what they should be talking about. And if you want to justify or discuss Landauer's principle, it should be in the context of that wider sort of project. And that's just not what's being done. So that's why I sort of just appealed to Landauer's principle just now. Don't just tell me, give me a sound horn of the dilemma, and Landauer's principle just sort of falls out of that. Right, what I want to know is give me a framework of system mechanics that works within an information theory perspective, and tell me why is Landauer's principle something I should believe in. Right, don't just sort of postulate it or sort of give me a story, either on a sound or profound form, however you want to construe that, and sort of say, well, we have to believe in Landauer's principle somehow. So I don't think I'm really disagreeing with you. I wrote my dissertation on James, and I was pretty much everything, or most of the stuff he's written on the subject, and I know he did a lot of it.
Maybe this is a good time with all the experts in the audience, just to educate myself. Information theory is a set of premises or axioms that that's being built up.
I'm already referring to yes. Okay.
And of course, all along the people that are now saying that information is really physics, right?
Uh-huh. I never really understood that.
Well, this is part of the inquiry. I think this is in one of the conferences I'm organizing.
I don't know what he meant. I know
what you meant.
It sounds true.
It's an attitude he's taken, but he's written those things out there. So putting these two things in parallel, of course, is the key here, right? There is so-called knowledge. You go and do something. Here's this, okay, and then you have your theory of knowledge. How is your theory of knowledge compared to the physical laws?
What do you mean by theory of knowledge?
I'm forgetting the
philosopher might mean something quite different. But
that's an earlier part of our discussion. But let me come back to the foundation aspect. When you set up an information theory, you are using it to describe some aspects of physical phenomena. Is it true?
Oh, well, I take it that's what's trying to be done in this case.
That's true.
I don't know if that's always the case. You're not always using information theory to describe physical phenomena. But in this case, that's precisely the approach.
So it seems to be a bigger theory than the physics that we know, which, of course, should be checked against nature. In fact, it's being carried out that way. For those who defy that, it's their own demise, right? So the information theory is true that most people working in information theory harbor the thought that it could be something wider than in the kind of parameter, right, space that they are functioning, wider than physical parameters and physical laws, right, being captured. And hence there seems to be a glimpse of hope that we might be able to enlarge our understanding of the physical world. For example, when people introduce information of the cosmos, like Seth Boyd. Now, I always get a little bit nervous when people try to do that. and that's why it comes back to
right, exactly
what's your starting point, right? It could be just a simple, simplistic system of way of using different words to describe the same thing. Or, in fact, I'd like to see a case where there is simply something new, some new ways of thinking, or that could, you know, inspire us to understand.
Right, so let me say something about that. So what I take information theory, or at least in this sort of context, is it's intended to be some kind of theory of inference.
Inference.
Right, it's supposed to tell us how to infer from some state of, you know, say in this case, a set of observables, what we should infer from the future state. And it, of course, information, you know, these sorts of approaches have wide application in other fields, not just in physics. You see these kinds of, you know, James did a lot of work, say, in imaging and image resolution. You see this sort of work in economics and so forth. Now, my personal perspective is that this probably the wrong thing to do is to try to universalize it, to think that just because it works in a couple of select fields that it somehow is the most fundamental theory of inference we could possibly have, right? So, you know, take on by analogy, one talks about, say, deductive logic, and we have a notion of deductive logic. Right, that, well, you've given a set of premises, the conclusion follows, and the conclusion could be false given the truth of those premises. Now, not everything follows the pattern of deductive logic. Not all our inferences do that. It's good for some things, and some things that are absolutely not good for. Similarly, at least in the history of philosophy of science, people thought about confirmation theory that way. Right? We had this notion of deductive logic, and it seemed to work really well. It was nicely formalized. It was just a matter of formal relations that held between the structure of the premises and the conclusion. And people thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we had a theory of inductive logic that was just like that? And that turned out to be a mess, because in a lot of ways, people came up with all sorts of ways in which they tried to think that you could just pigeonhole all inductive inferences into one sort of formal schema, and that was, you know, a disaster of the 20th century philosophy of science in some sense. So I just don't see why one would want to universalize forms of inference in that way. You can say, look, we have a theory of information theory as, or at least the sort of core of information theory that as being a theory of inference. And it's applicable to some things, and it's applicable not to other things. And I think it's an interesting question to ask why it's applicable to those things that it is applicable to, and why it's not applicable to those things to which it's not. And that might give us some genuine insight into the structure of the universe, but and it may not. If you say, well, look, a Coulomb attraction force is an inverse square law, Newton's law is an inverse square law, let's look for something that they have in common. You can look for something deeper, you may or may not find something. Or at least, you know, if you were a 19th century physicist, you might have been struck by that fact, and you might try to model every other force that you see as an inverse square law. It turns out they're not all inverse square laws, and they're not all central forces. So, it might be a path that might be worth pursuing. I don't want to denigrate that idea, but you know, the thought that you're somehow going to, you know, latch onto the structure of the universe by appealing to information theory is this universal notion that strikes me as being very bold and ambitious. Is that sort of?
Okay, well, I'm with you.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm more interested in the local issues.
Yeah, right, but on the other hand, there are people who said famous people who said it from bit.
Yeah, I guess.
So
yeah.
Top of that is that it's really the bit that we really need to understand, that if the realization or the manifestation of some aspect of how bits come about gives us the bit, right? There's that philosophy which of course makes information theory so.
Yeah, I'm not really sure that I have a clear understanding what that's supposed to mean. I mean, I hear people say it, and there's probably other people in this room that can probably make more sense of it than I can. But I haven't carefully investigated what's being meant by that, and I'm not sure that, at least to my ear, that it has to mean.
Just picking up on what you were saying about other people in the room, while that discussion was going on, I was actually hoping Chris would. Chris, hello. That person possibly is closest to the people who have actually espoused that kind of
right idea.
You wouldn't want to say something on that.
Yeah.
Chris, tell us what it from bit means.
I don't know what it means. I think that Rolf Landauer did the field a great disservice by saying information is physical. Because I think that is destroying the very distinction that James strove for during much of his life. There is the physical, and then there is our information about it. And information is precisely not physical.
Yeah.
It lives at the plane, or at least the way James and other Bayesians imagine probability theory and information theory. It lives up at the plane of logic.
Okay.
It's not identical with it, but it's living in that plane. It comes before physics.
Mm-hmm.
And then one might say, what can I learn about physics from considering how I might, or the limitations to how I can process information, that gives you a back door to saying some statements about physics sometimes. So, I think what a much better statement in place of Landauer's, and I had just planned to tell him this right before he died, and luckily for me, actually he died. Before I said this, because he would have surely seen that. But I think a much better phrase for what he was aiming for would be that information carriers are physical. And this is what it's about. So I think that's a disservice. When one says information is physical, then I've seen so many people in this community. I used to accuse Jeff Boob of this, as taking that phrase and thinking of information as just yet a new fluid. Ah, we used to have phlogiston, now we have information.
Yeah.
It's a fluid, and it flows.
I've had long discussions with Jeff about this as well.
And that's the wrong sort of thing.
Right, no, but I agree entirely with your, and that's pretty much what I think I was just saying previously, is that, you know, this notion of, at least for James, is probability theory, it's logic. And furthermore, I added to that I don't think all, except the doctor were inductive logic, I don't think that every logical system is universalizable. Some logical systems are appropriate for some problems, like, for instance, and some aren't.
Yeah. I have a question for you, or maybe it's for Chris.
Okay.
But let me preface it by saying I think logic is also physics.
Oh.
So yeah. Logic is also physics. Well, logic is physical, not only information. But But the question is, would you be unhappy if, suppose someone gave an account of information that's a specialized form of entropy? I don't know if that's what Landauer meant or not, but it seems to me that's natural for a physicist to say.
Information is a form of entropy.
Yeah, or perhaps with a minus sign. Yeah, it's a measure of some contribution of human beings or whatever system is bearing the information to the total entropy.
What's the entropy referring to?
There has to be a physical notion of entropy. Boltzmann, let's call it Boltzmann entropy.
Okay.
So you have a Boltzmann entropy for a system that includes the demon, for example, and uses it there.
So it's the sort of
When you're measuring information, you're measuring it in entropy units. And all these.
But they're inconvertible? Something, I mean, that's a sort of thesis that was.
One is a special case. I don't know if they're interconvertible. One is a special case of the other.
Those kinds of claims you could see in the 50s being advanced by people like Valentinian.
Who?
Everywhere. Yeah, I struggle with that. It's weird.
Name whatever. Yeah. So that.
You said
so
you can pronounce
this is not. This is somehow not congruent with the point of view that you're
No, I mean it's trying to establish. I'm not sure what you're espousing.
I don't have a definite whole theory worked out, but I'm not that. Sort of interested in information in itself, but at least to the extent I'm interested, I don't have time to worry about working out the whole theory. And the idea would be that what you're seeing with the failure of Maxwell's demon
mm-hmm.
is just the increase of entropy for a larger system consisting of the demon plus the box of gas. And so we...
Well, there is no entropy increase. I mean, all the processes here are, you know, the process as a whole is... I mean, if you take it, if you take the sort of stronger sense, right, at the end of the day, you have no net entropy decrease. You reset the daemon's memory.
Not in the daemon itself, but the whole system has an entropy increase.
Well,
or maybe it doesn't increase, but it doesn't decrease. That's the point. It's a non-decrease law for the whole system. That's what that's the essential physical concept, it seems to me, of the state
right,
of Maxwell's daemons.
I think that is.
But I mean, like, but as Owen will tell you, this has nothing to do with information whatsoever.
But I mean, just in that system, if you include the heat back, and you're taking the Boltzmann entropies of the thing, then that non-decrease law has failed because the Boltzmann entropy of that system hasn't increased, and the heat has been extracted from the heat back, decreasing entropy. So there's been a net decrease in the Boltzmann entropy.
Well, that's not
of the universe.
All you need to do is we were discussing
at
lunch.
That's not our. Yeah, I mean, we could argue over the whole point of view. I don't think those things are clearly refutations of it. There's the whole issue of the memory. I mean, I don't want to sort of right now rehearse the whole thing. I'm just asking you what your reaction was to that point of view. I guess your reaction is totally negative as far as
I'm concerned. I'm just not clear. It's not that it's entirely negative. I'm just not sure that I understand. I mean, you don't have a specific proposal to float. And as it stands,
yeah,
sort of
yeah,
thing.
I did tell you the proposal. We can argue whether it's true or false. But it's meant to give a sense of the type of proposal, what would seem to me a physical understanding of information. But I did make a specific proposal. Maybe it's probably false, maybe it's not. But
well, I'm just not clear. I mean, in the proposal, but I'm not clear what you mean by entropy, what you mean by information. In those cases, so I mean,
the proposal is to understand information as a special case of entropy.
Okay.
Entropy has to be given, of course, a definition. I'm not proposing to give the exact resolution of that whole problem.
Right. I mean,
I want to think of it as something.
The closest thing I can liken it to is the sort of the claims that Lillian made in the 50s,
yeah,
saying that it's just entropy or information is just what he called neg entropy, and. And we have there's a nice analysis in that Ehrman and Morton paper that I cite that sort of says this is just playing around with terms and it's not clear that there's anything substantive there. So you may have something different in mind than what was proposed, you know, 50 years ago, but I'm just not clear on what you're suggesting. And if you want to clarify, that's fine. And maybe I'm just too steeped in the literature that I'm hearing something that you know that you're saying that you're not intending.
Unfortunately, I have to go now, but...
I actually think I can defend Raphael.
Okay, sure.
Because I think this was, in Landauer's at least the first paper. I don't have a sharp memory of it like you guys do. But this was my reading of it at that time.
The first paper being...
His first paper where he...
62?
Yeah, somewhere around 61.
61, okay, sorry.
So my reading of it was that he started with the idea of virtual mechanics,
mm-hmm.
and that when there is a distribution on phase space, if you just think of a flat distribution over an area, phase space volume is preserved mm-hmm. under Hamiltonian dynamics. And then he imagined what would be going on, for instance, in a situation where was a daemon. Maybe I'll make some papers up.
Has he even actually talked about some of that demon?
Yeah, I don't think I'll
But he talked about this idea of erasure. And the whole point of why erasure would cost you is because you would have to take a phase space distribution that was of you know size 2 and convert it to
right.
size
1. Press the phase space.
So if you imagine that was being enacted
mm-hmm.
by some external system,
mm-hmm.
then you would just say, well, the external system started off at some standard state, and I've got these two bumps. And when they decrease to 1 rather than 2, then something has to bulge out over here. So he's invoking Hamiltonian
yeah.
dynamics, and that's what justifies the whole principle.
All right.
And then ultimately, that's what justifies And, you know, Bennett just took that on.
Yeah.
In any way, modify it. And so the assumption is you've got Hamiltonian or unitary dynamics.
Yeah.
And within a big overall understanding of daemon plus system, if you still have Hamiltonian or unitary dynamics, then there's no violation of the second law.
Well, there can't be because, I mean, and that's
a principle and stuff. And I think that's what Raphael was trying to get at.
Well, okay.
I'll have the counter-example to that. His point is that the phase space of the volume of the initial macrostate of the daemon, in those proofs, it's assumed that the daemon ends up in, is guaranteed to end up in one particular macrostate. You allow the daemon to end up in one of several possible macrostates.
Right, that's just the point of this. That's just the point of this example, right? And this I just took the example right up to the point that that Bennett does until he compresses it back, pushes it back to the ready state, and he says, well, you need to reset the daemon, so you need to invoke Landauer's principle, and that's what saves the second law. Right, and I just thought right before you invoke Landauer's principle, because I didn't want to talk about Landauer's principle. Now, I think you can...
All I was trying to do
right,
is
right,
I think Raphael had something sensible in mind, and it was roughly what Landauer had in mind.
Right, and I understand
what... So if Landauer is wrong, Raphael's wrong.
Okay.
And that's as far as I want to go.
Right, but all I wanted to sort of say on these points is that, well, look, we have perfectly good depth, we have a notion of a probability distribution that we can apply on information theory account. We think that the entropy is somehow a function of that. And we should be able to tell a story about what the second law says and so forth without having to invoke Landauer's principle. I mentioned it once or twice in the paper, but I didn't appeal to it at any point. And I think that what ultimately you want to do is you want to be able to tell a story about what information theorists means and what the second law actually says without saying anything about Landauer's principle. And then there'll be a further question as to whether or not Landauer's principle is a true or a false principle. And I'm not committed either way. I guess, you know, papers by folks who say that it's probably false. I'm not convinced either way, and I don't see why I have to be a believer in Landauer's principle in order to investigate, you know, or come to a coherent understanding of what one means by an information theory approach to this mechanics. And that's what I, in some sense, decry the literature for on a subject.
Yeah. We should probably call it off at this point.
Okay.
I want to talk to you.
Sure.